Welcome to the Deep Dive. For a while now, we've talked about data mostly in terms of averages, sums, you know, descriptive stuff.
Right. Summaries.
Exactly. But today, we're shifting gears. We're getting into the, well, the real machinery underneath, the statistical tests we use to check our assumptions and say how confident we are.
It's a big leap. It's moving from saying, this group looks taller, to actually stating, we're 95% confident their average height is truly different.
Okay.
You start with an idea, a hypothesis, let's call it H.
Yeah.
You measure something, then you use that measurement to decide, do I stick with H or do I need to change my mind?
And that decision hinges on confidence and significance, right? The source material had this great little example.
Yeah, the lecture room one.
Right. You assume the lecture's always in room A.
Yep.
Check 100 times, find it there 85 times.
Yeah.
So you're what, 85% confident in your sign?
Precisely. And that leftover bit, that 15 times it wasn't there, that's where significance comes in. Significance is just one minus your confidence.
So 50% significance in that case.
Exactly. And that probability, the chance that maybe the sign is right, and those 15 empty days were just bad luck.
Yeah.
That's the p-value. Here, p equals 0.15.
Okay, p-value, got it. So before we get into the tests themselves, we need to be clear about what we're actually testing against, these initial assumptions.
Yeah, good point. We almost always set up two competing ideas. First is the null hypothesis, H0 or H0.
H0, that's the default, right? The boring one.
Kind of, yeah. It's the status quo assumption. Nothing interesting is happening. The lecture sign is correct. The average speed is 120. The die is fair.
And the challenger?
That's the alternate hypothesis, HA. This says, nope, the status quo is wrong. The sign's misleading. The speed isn't 120. The die is loaded.
So the whole point of these tests is to see if we have enough evidence to, like, ditch H0 and go with HA.
That's the game, exactly. Is the evidence strong enough to reject the null?
Okay, H0, HA. Got the framework.
Yeah.
Now, the source material had this really fascinating, almost mind-bending bit about high dimensions.
Oh, yeah, the law of large numbers connection. It's not what you'd expect.
Right, because normally you think, okay, random vectors in 3D space.
Mm.
Pick two, the angle between them. Totally random. Could be anything.
No pattern at all in low dimensions.
But then they jump to like D784 dimensions. Suddenly you pick any two random vectors, and the angle between them isn't random anymore. It clusters.
It clusters very tightly around a specific value. It seems weird, like adding complexity should add more randomness, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the opposite. It's the law of large numbers showing up in geometry. Because you have so many independent, identically distributed components,
right?
When you calculate things like dot products or lengths, the randomness averages out. The overall behavior becomes predictable, determined by the distribution's properties.
So the angle, theta, mm-hmm. becomes the key measurement here. Tells us how related the vectors are. 0 degrees means identical. 90 degrees means totally unrelated, orthogonal.
Exactly. And this is where the hypothesis testing comes in, because the angle depends on the distribution you use to generate the vector components.
Okay, scenario one they tested. Components from a standard normal distribution means zero.
Right. And when they did that 20 times in 784 dimensions, the angles all clumped right around 90 degrees.
90 degrees. Orthogonal, independent.
Which strongly supports the null hypothesis, H0. It suggests there's no inherent relationship or structure connecting these random vectors, just like you'd expect with a mean of zero.
But then, scenario two, they switched the distribution, used a binomial, like a coin flip for each component.
Single fair coin toss, yeah.
Yeah.
So N1, P0.5, still random components, but a different underlying distribution.
And the angle.
Suddenly, it snapped to cluster around 60 degrees, consistently.
Wow. Okay, why 60?
There's actually a neat formula for it. Cosine of theta is approximately mu squared divided by mu squared plus sigma squared.
Ah, mean and variance.
Exactly. If the mean mu is zero, like in the normal case, cosine is zero, angle is 90 degrees. But the binomial coin flip has a non-zero mean. Plug that in and you get cosine equals 0.5, which means theta is 60 degrees.
So that 60 degrees supports the alternate hypothesis, HA. It shows a structure imposed by the distribution.
Precisely. It shows the vectors aren't just randomly orthogonal anymore. Their relationship is dictated by that underlying non-zero mean.
So the big takeaway for, you know, for us listening,
it's that in high dimensions, you absolutely cannot just assume things are independent or random in the way you might intuitively think. You need to know about the underlying distribution, its mean, its variance. That knowledge defines the geometry.
That's really something. Okay, let's pull back from high D space and get back to more familiar ground. Testing means, population mean, mu, using samples.
Right. And the first test, the sort of textbook starting point, is the z-test.
And the crucial thing here is you use the z-test when you know the population standard deviation sigma.
Yeah.
Which feels kind of rare in real life.
Often, yes. It's a bit of a luxury. But if you do know sigma, or sometimes with large sample proportions, the z-test is powerful. It lets you define a very precise confidence interval.
And you use that interval to check your hypothesis, right? See if your assumed mean mu0 falls inside or outside.
Exactly. That determines if you reject H0.
Let's use the speed camera example they gave. Makes it concrete. Speed limit's 120. The null hypothesis, H0, is that the driver's true average speed, mu, is 120 or less. They're innocent.
And the authorities want to be really sure they don't wrongly fine people. They set the significance level, alpha, at 1%.
Alpha 0.01, meaning they'll accept at most a 1% chance of finding someone who is actually driving at or below the limit.
Before we see the result, we should quickly define the errors you can make in any test like this.
Good idea. Two types, right?
Yep. Type I error is rejecting H0 when it's actually true, a false positive.
So in the camera case, that's finding an innocent driver, someone really going on 20.
Mm-hmm.
And the probability of that happening is alpha itself.
Exactly. P-type I error is alpha 0.01 here.
In type 2.
Type 2 error, beta, is the opposite. It's failing to reject H0 when it's actually false, a false negative.
Missing something. So letting a guilty driver, someone speeding 120, go free.
Correct.
Okay, error is defined. Back to the z-test cameras. They know sigma, they set alpha, 0.01. What's the verdict?
The z-test calculation, using the known sigma, tells them they need an average recorded speed of at least 122.2 miles per hour to reject H0, the driver being innocent, while keeping that alpha risk at 1%.
So 122.2 is the cutoff. If the average is below that, you don't find them. If it's above, you do.
Right. But setting alpha that low, being so careful not to make a type I error, it has a consequence.
It affects the type 2 error rate, beta.
It does. It reduces the test's power, which is defined as 1 minus beta. Power is the probability of correctly rejecting a false H0.
Catching the guilty driver.
Exactly. And the source showed that with this setup, the test only had about 40% power to catch someone whose true average speed was 122.
Only 40%. Wow. So 60% of people actually averaging 122 would get away with it under this test.
That's the trade-off. You minimize false positives, but you increase false negatives. Beta goes up.
Okay. That sets up the next big question perfectly. What happens when we don't have that luxury? When we don't know sigma?
Well, now everything changes. If you don't know the population standard deviation sigma, you have to estimate it from your sample data using the sample standard deviation S.
And that means no more z-test.
No more z-test. You have to switch to the t-test. And this introduces more uncertainty.
Because S is just an estimate from the sample, not the true population value sigma.
Exactly. So to account for that extra uncertainty, we have to make an assumption that the underlying population data is normally distributed and we use a different distribution, the student's T distribution.
The T distribution. I remember that one. It looks kind of like the normal bell curve, but
yeah,
like fatter tails.
Especially with small samples, yes. The tails are thicker, reflecting that greater uncertainty about the true standard deviation. It also has this parameter called degrees of freedom, usually n minus 1, where n is your sample size.
And as the sample size gets huge, the t distribution basically becomes the normal distribution.
Correct. The uncertainty decreases. But for smaller samples, it's quite different.
So let's rerun the speed camera scenario. Same recorded speeds, same goal, alpha 0.01. But this time, crucially, we pretend we don't know sigma. We only have the sample S.
Okay. So the t-test now uses S. Because the t-distribution have those fatter tails, to maintain that same strict alpha of 0.01, the cutoff speed has to be pushed a bit higher.
Higher than the z-test 122.2.
Yeah, the calculation comes out around 122.7 now. You need slightly stronger evidence to reject H0 because you're less certain overall.
Wait a second. So with the z-test, knowing sigma, the threshold was 122.2. We said if the average speed was, say, 122.5, you'd reject H0 and find the driver.
Correct. 120 would be outside the calculated confidence interval in that z-test setup.
But now, with the t-test using the exact same data but just acknowledging we don't know sigma, the cutoff is 122.7, so that same average speed of 122.5.
So it's now below the cutoff.
So you don't reject H0.
You do not reject H0. The t-test analysis using the confidence interval derived from the t-distribution would now find that the hypothetical innocent speed of 120 is inside the interval.
That's honestly amazing. The decision completely flips. fine versus no fine, based only on whether you assume sigma is known or estimate it with S.
It's a powerful illustration of how assumptions matter. The t-test reflects the price of uncertainty. It forces a more conservative conclusion when you have less information. No fine.
Incredible. Okay, we've handled means with known and unknown variance. What about data that isn't numerical like speed, but categorical, like counts of things?
Ah, now we move into a different family of tests. The chi-squared tests. These are designed specifically for count data for categories.
Two main types, right? Goodness of fit and independence.
That's right. The first one, chi-squared goodness of fit, is basically asking, do my observed counts match some expected theoretical pattern?
Like the unfair die example.
Perfect example. H0 is the die is fair. You expect each face, 1 through 6, to come up about the same number of times if you roll it a lot. Say, 120 rolls, you expect 20 counts for each face.
But your observed counts are different. Maybe you see, like, 29 for the 5-foot and 28 for the 6, and way fewer for 1 and 2.
Exactly. The chi-squared test calculates a statistic based on how far the observed counts deviate from those expected counts.
And for the die example, what was the result?
The calculation yielded a p-value of 0.0264.
Okay, 0.0264. That's less than the standard alpha threshold of 0.05.
Correct. Since p is less than alpha, we reject H0.
Conclusion. The die is probably not fair. The differences are too big to just be random chance.
That's the conclusion, yep. The observed counts do not provide a good fit to the theoretical fair die distribution.
Okay, that's goodness of fit. What about the other one, the independence test?
The chi-squared independence test is probably used even more often. It asks, are two categorical variables independent of each other? Or is there some relationship, some correlation between them?
You usually see this with contingency tables, right? Rows are one category, columns are another.
Exactly. The classic example is something like gender versus political party affiliation. You survey, say, 300 people, and you tally the counts in a table. Males, females in one dimension, Democrat, Republican, Independent in the other.
So it's a 2x3 table of counts.
Right. And H0 here is that gender and party affiliation are completely independent. Knowing someone's gender gives you no information about their likely party preference, and vice versa.
And HA is that they are related, they're correlated somehow.
Correct. The test compares the observed counts in your table to the counts you would expect to see if independence were perfectly true.
And in the sources example, with the 300 people.
The chi-squared test gave a p-value of 0.0401.
0.0401. Okay, that's again just under the 0.05 significance level.
Right. So following the standard procedure, the conclusion was to reject H0.
Meaning gender and party affiliation were found to be not independent in that sample. They are correlated.
Yes. But it's important, as you mentioned, to remember what the test doesn't say. It just flags the dependence. It doesn't explain the nature of the relationship or the specific probabilities involved. Just that the independence assumption doesn't hold up against the data.
Got it. It just says related, not how.
Pretty much.
Wow. Okay. We've covered a lot of ground today. Starting with the whole idea of H0 and HA.
Yeah, the basic framework.
Then that surprising detour into high dimensions. And the law of large numbers.
How structure emerges from randomness, yeah.
The navigating the z-test versus the t-test for means. Seeing how knowing sigma or not can completely change the result.
Like of uncertainty.
And finally, landing on the chi-squared test for handling categorical counts and checking independence.
Z, T, and chi-squared, the three big families for these fundamental kinds of tests.
And tying it back to that speed camera example on the errors, we saw that the probability of a type I error, finding the innocent, is fixed by your choice of alpha.
Always. P type I, alpha. You choose it.
But the type 2 error, beta, letting the guilty go free, that depends on the true situation, like how fast the person was actually going.
And on the test's design, we saw the t-test version might only have, 24% power to catch someone actually doing 122?
Yeah, really low power in that specific scenario. Which leads to maybe a final thought for everyone listening. When you're setting up any system that relies on statistical testing, whether it's for regulation, science, quality control, whatever, you face this fundamental trade-off driven by your choice of alpha. Is it more critical to minimize type I errors to protect the innocent at all costs, even if it means lower power to catch the guilty?
Or do you prioritize maximizing power, 1 minus beta, making sure you detect the effect or catch the culprit, even if it slightly increases the risk of a false alarm? Your alpha choice dictates that balance. So the question for you, the listener, is where would you set that balance in different situations? What kind of error are you more willing to tolerate?